Back in 1848, when they found gold in California, dreamers packed up their things, hopped on the trails, and headed west. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, our guests say we're in the middle of a modern-day gold rush for glittering, shiny mobile apps. And believe it or not, KC is home to one of the highest densities of app makers per square mile. Today, we learn how lean digital marketing companies are making big advertising firms reach for another drink and another cigarette. And we'll learn about a local company competing in a social media madness tournament with 3 million of their followers cheering them on. That plus, the future is here. Hear how iVein biometrics might be the way you pay for things soon. We explore collaborative tech innovation in KC with Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Pablo Picasso once said that computers were useless because they only give you answers and don't ask you any questions. But even the great master of the abstract never could have imagined the world of apps, interactive in nature, flexible, scalable, and a case study themselves in the elusive question and answer conversation among technologists and everyday people. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Now, whether you know it or not, KC is the place to be for app creation and development, and there's a lot of ancillary technology that comes around that. And we've invited more tech innovators who are here to talk about their place in the overall scope of technology entrepreneurship in the region, along with telling you a little bit about their business. We have Michael Wilson, the Chief Executive Officer for Wavelength. Jeremy Pabin, he's the Chief of Engineering, the VP, rather, of Engineering at iVerify. And Evan Conway, President of One Louder Apps. He'll be joining us for the conversation. All three of these gentlemen, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Why do you think KC, Mike, is a great place for app developers?
That's a great question. First, I got to tell you, great intro. That was solid. I appreciate that intro. Kansas City, I would say one of the things is that it's probably one of the most open and collaborative communities I've ever come across. One of the few things that I think myself and other people that own businesses here is that doors are easily opened. It's a very small and well-connected city, and I think from the mobile sphere, with this technology boom we're seeing down in the crossroads in Kansas City as a whole, is the availability for resources to get with talent, other firms to help you accelerate your process. I think that's really been, from our standpoint, what's really helped driven us is the availability of other people to help accelerate what we're doing.
So is it more collaborative or are people just more helpful?
Both. We've seen more collaborative. There's definitely people on both sides of the helpful and not helpful standpoint. You know, there's old school mentality and new school mentality, and the new school is that collaborative piece. But really, I've seen more of the collaborative side.
Moving on, this is a question that I presume is the appropriate time now that Google Fiber's come out. Will it change the way you do your business at all? And then I'm going to go over to Evan Conway to have him follow up on that. Google Fiber.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you give me a car that goes 150 miles an hour and you let me go that fast, I'd get to the other point faster. Doesn't necessarily change the fact that I have a car. I think with Google Fiber, it's going to change the way we do business in the sense of how we the expectations of how quickly things are done or the way we can share things. But really what I think it's done is it's sparked or awakened this sleeping giant that's here in Kansas City, and that's that entrepreneurial technology piece we've always had, but we really haven't recognized. And so I think we've all kind of rallied behind that now that we've got the national spotlight with Google Fiber. So I really think that's what it's doing the most is lighting that fire.
So now that Google Fiber's here, you're going to jump in your car and floor it.
I do that anyway. So, you know, I don't know if that will change that piece.
And you have a background in that, and we'll talk about that in a few moments. Evan Conway, what do you think Google Fiber brings to the equation as far as businesses being able to move at the speed of thought or as fast as this guy in his car?
Yeah. Well, in our space where we're doing mobile applications and mobile advertising and things like that, it doesn't so much actually affect how people use our products. But I think he hit the nail on the head. It's put a spotlight on the area, and it's getting attention for a tech community that maybe didn't shine so bright before. So you're seeing people from all over the country. I've got friends on both coasts that are calling and saying, "Hey, that's cool. How'd you guys get selected?" And I think perhaps in the long run, maybe the most important thing it'll do for us is kind of invigorate the population, invigorate the people around here to kind of be involved in technology in some way, and help create an environment where people will feel more comfortable moving here from other places, and say, hey, this is, one of the cool spots to be.
But even before the Google Fiber ramp up, this area was known for app creation, app designers, and innovative stuff along those lines. Moving beyond what can be construed as regional boosterism, do you think there really is a gold rush of apps in the Silicon Prairie?
Well, it's interesting that the gold rush for apps, just generally speaking, it's probably a lot like the gold rush in the sense that tons of people were doing it and very few people were making any money, at it. With over 500,000 apps, in each of the major stores, very few of them, really get noticed in interesting ways, I think the real thing with mobile is broad. It's allowed very small groups of people to do things in interesting ways. It doesn't take, a 50-person company or, multi, national huge corporation to do these sorts of things. 2, 3, 4, 5 people, in their garage have been able to create, really interesting things. If you look at Instagram selling for $1 billion to Facebook, that's a company with less than 20 employees. So all of a sudden, the speed of innovation.
And no profits.
Yeah, exactly. No revenues.
No revenues, exactly.
The whole speed of innovation associated with mobile is so different than software development from, even 5, 10, 20 years ago where, With our apps, we're doing an update on every single one of them every single month, some of them, 2 or 3 times a month. That's so different than the old days of a big software program of an update once, maybe twice a year.
You're called upon, Mike Wilson, to give talks on digital technology and how it evolves. Tell us about Wavelength, why you started it, and take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, really the genesis of where Wavelength started is I was a marketing manager and a marketing director for a variety of companies, mostly not in the agency side, but more on manufacturing and food equipment and later on a chemical company. And really it turned into lifestyle design for me. And it was, I pictured 5 years down the road and I was getting serious with my girlfriend and, I pictured this life. And so really I looked at, I saw an opportunity on one side, and that was, hey, people aren't really doing it well out there. I felt like the agency world was bloated. People really weren't doing a good job on the digital side in agencies, and there was a lot of agencies failing in town. So I looked at that side, and I looked at, I'm young, and I got an opportunity. So I went and made the leap, and my business partner and I decided to create Wavelength as a digital marketing agency. And so we got into the web and digital sphere as a whole, so social, mobile, all that great stuff. We really got going in and changed the way that the agency model was working in the sense that we took a lean approach. We utilized technology. We started utilizing platforms like RareWire to build mobile applications. The speed of development, cost of development is really how we got in the game. So we started delivering great products at drastically different cost structures than what was previously there. And that really accelerated us to where we are today is, contender in the agency side of things and growing like a weed.
Did you eat low-fat muffins, low-carb diet as well, the lean approach?
I pretty much, that. And when you go out on your own, you make that leap, you also take the lean money approach. So, you're selling your 401k and your car for cash in order to follow your dream and all that great stuff. So, I definitely took a lean approach holistically there.
Certainly. How do apps play into digital marketing and digital marketing strategies?
Well, I think people really underestimate what an app is. A lot of people just think, Angry Birds or Instagram, these kind of consumer-facing pieces. But there's all sorts of value you can deliver through a mobile application, whether that be content, that be a university delivering content, engaging with alumni, or that be a B2B type of system that provides information tying into a CRM. And really, I've just seen that there's all sorts of ways you can provide value through an application. And the great part is that mobile apps have really evolved to be where the text messaging boom was and all this other stuff that involved with mobile phones. The mobile phone's just always on you. I mean, it's one of the very few things that is always available to you. So whether it's sending push notifications for an event or that's providing, you know, tools or utilities that make you more productive, mobile's really been one of those things. It's like, you know, being able to have a computer in your pocket all the time. And so being able to recognize that value, I think, has been really exciting. And that's what we've been delivering for our clients, is seeing those opportunities and delivering mobile to connect and engage with customers and clients.
We're going to demystify the corporate and marketing bureaucraties and say that CRM is customer relationship management and B2B is business to business.
Yes.
So those are the first references.
Yes.
For our listeners that are out there that may or may not know that. You guys might be saying that during this hour, so you just want to get that clear.
Yes, I'll re-preface. I'll try to cut down on my lingo and make sure that I cover those pieces. Yeah.
Why don't you just say in parentheses after you say that?
Okay. Well, you know, it'd be cool. It'd be cool if you could see me, and then I could actually do finger parentheses,
right,
and I
right.
could say B2B.
Is finger parentheses different from air quotes?
You know, I would say that it's almost – I feel like air quotes. I like air quotes better.
Okay.
Air quotes.
Speaking of air quotes.
Yes.
User-centric design. You see how I made the inflection
in my
voice
that.
Too?
Yeah, I like that. I can hear that through the radio.
What does user-centric design mean? You say that a lot in your talks. What is user-centric design about?
User-centric design is really about user experience, or what it's like in the shoes of a user. And I think that's a lot has gotten lost in the development process is – people want to deliver functionality, but never really think of how that impacts how a user interacts with it. So it really it's exactly what it sounds like. It's all about the interactions and things that make you happy and drive your decisions to use something.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests today are three local technology people. Technologists, technology practitioners. We're talking about local app creation, tech entrepreneurship, and new and exciting applications in the tech world. Michael Wilson is the Chief Executive Officer of Wavelength. Jeremy Pabin, he's the VP of Engineering at iVerify. And I have my eye on you over at iVerify. We'll be talking about your company later. And Evan Conway, the President of One Louder Apps, is also joining the conversation. And KC, you can join the conversation now. Chime in on why you think KC is the place to be for the next wave of technological innovation. What makes the environment so malleable and so amenable to technological innovation and entrepreneurship? At KCURCST is our Twitter handle. We're following tweets and also taking email comments at centralstandard@kcur.org. If you're so excited about the technology infrastructure and business environment here, you can also use an analog device called a phone, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And join the conversation about tech entrepreneurship and innovation here in KC. You've been an entrepreneur, Michael Wilson, since age 16. First, before you tell us what you started out doing, any words of advice for budding tech entrepreneurs?
Yes, and I would say the biggest piece of that is expect to work a lot harder than you, well, expect to work. I think that's one of the biggest pieces people underestimate is they typically get into business and they think they're going to be, you know, working 20, 30 hours a week, and they're going to be golfing and all that stuff. Until you really build a business, it's probably the longest and most grueling marathon you're ever going to be involved in. So if you're truly dedicated, you're going to be spending hundreds of hours a week, and you're going to be sacrificing a lot. And I think that's one thing, is to make sure you curve your expectations when you get into business.
Not your enthusiasm, but your expectations.
Absolutely. Good pun.
Well, okay. Talk about what you started out doing. You mentioned that you like to drive cars very fast. So it's very appropriate that you started out doing what you started out doing at age 16. Tell us about it.
Well, it's also appropriate, I will say, as filling in on that, is that I've had a lot of speeding tickets in my time, and now one of our clients is a producer of radar equipment. So I feel like I make full circle in all this. I'm getting caught by it, and I'm also helping sell it. But we really started out when I was 16 years old with an aftermarket auto accessories business called Lefty's Auto. And I had a beat-up 1987 Corvette as a car, which was a cool car for a 16-year-old. And I was really looking to get parts for it that was affordable. So I started a business to be able to get wholesale parts. And I quickly recognized when the movie Fast and Furious came out that there was this odd desire for everybody wanting to get parts from this from the movie. So I went and set up distributorships with the companies that provided the parts in the movies, and I started selling the guy. I was the guy that was selling the parts from the Fast and Furious. And really what helped drive that when I was a kid was I created an online catalog. It was really when digital started providing functionality for people. And so I created an online catalog that I could push people to, drive word-of-mouth traffic. And it really allowed me to compete in Kansas City in that whole aftermarket auto accessory business. And I didn't have to work at McDonald's or anywhere like that when I was in high school. So.
And it was also an opportunity for you to see the power of the internet and how e-commerce works and sort of set the stage for other ventures.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, the thing is that I think I heard one time from actually an interview with Warren Buffett and Jay-Z. It was one of the most interesting paired interviews I've ever seen. But both of them say, you know, why they asked, why are you successful? And they said, well, I've just been kind of doing it longer than most people. And that's one of the things Warren Buffett started reading books on investing at 8. And so I attribute to what we do now and the success I'm having in these ventures is I got a lot of my mistakes and my naive perspective out at 16, 17, 18 years old. And so now that I'm 28, I've got a little bit more of an understanding of what it's like to run a business.
Spending cheese. Spending cheese. That's a Jay-Z reference. Evan Conway, you said One Louder is the biggest company you've never heard of in the mobile application space. Why is that?
Well, I think people are surprised that right here in Kansas City is, you know, really one of the leaders in the world, you know, in the space. One Louder, we've done 20 million downloads since the beginning of last year. Every other company you've done that you've probably heard of, you know, in the mobile advertising space, it's, you know, we're right up there in a sense, you know, with Pandora and Shazam and the ESPN app and things like that. All our apps are free. And So we've kind of created what I think is this little oasis for folks that wanted the opportunity to kind of, you know, do the Silicon Valley thing, but do it right here in Kansas City with still, you know, a lifestyle, you know, associated with the Midwest. You know, most of our developers, you know, have families, most of them have children and things like that. And to be able to kind of pull that off with a kind of a very hard driving, doing updates every single week, you know, kind of approach. To combine that, you know, with more of a kind of family-oriented Kansas City lifestyle has been pretty amazing. It's allowed us to attract, I think, the very best people in the region.
How were you able to move in such silence for so long?
Well, first of all, our brands are better known, you know, our actual apps, you know, than our company name. So One Louder, which gets its name from Spinal Tap for you Christopher Guest fans, you know, most people know us from Tweetcaster, one of the first Android apps, you know, to do Twitter. And we started it really, I started as a marketing experiment, frankly, as a way to get Twitter followers, you know, and it's worked. You know, we're up to about 3.5 million Twitter followers.
How does Tweetcast work, just to explain to our audience?
Tweetcaster is another way to access Twitter. And we've even launched another one since then called Slices that we just launched over the last 2 weeks. So if you go out and Google search Slices or hashtag Slices search out on Twitter, you know, you'll find, you know, pretty amazing, you know, phenomenon over the last 2 weeks. It's the only app ever, you know, in history that's been featured by Apple, Google, and Amazon all at the same time, you know, on their app stores. So people know us through those products. We've got some called Bacon Reader. It's a Reddit app. Friendcaster is a Facebook app. Bacon Reader. So that comes back from the early days of Reddit. The hardcore Redditors used to, you know, say, I'm going to read my bacon. So it's just kind of an in little thing.
Nothing to do with real bacon.
Very little to do with real bacon, actually. and a weather app and different things like that. So if you go out on Google Play, you know, for example, you know, look at any of the categories. You go to the social categories, you'll find, you know, all 8 of our apps are, you know, ranked in the top, you know, top group. The only company I know of that's probably got 3 apps in the top 25, say, in the social category, you know, out there right now.
You also have another app called Friendcaster. What's that about?
It's a Facebook app. So it's just another way to use Facebook. There's a variety of people that haven't been, you know, super psyched about the changes Facebook's made and the way the stream, you know, works and things like that. So it's a little more true to the original vision of Facebook and how you're getting your posts and updates and pictures and stuff through that. So again, each one of these Facebook right now, I'm sorry, Friendcaster's probably our second or third biggest app, you know, behind our Twitter apps, and we've got a messaging app called Powwow out there. But you know, every single day, you know, a couple of million people use one of our apps every single day.
Wow. And how do they work? Do they work as conduits to these programs, help people better access the programs or customize how they see the programs? Explain how they work.
Well, it's different in different cases, you know. And again, if you think about apps in general, you know, apps are just huge right now. The idea, I think people are stunned when they start thinking about apps versus the web and stuff. But even on the desktop, if you think about it, apps are passing, you know, web usage, you know, and people forget things like Outlook are actually apps, you know, and Wired did a great story, you know, recently said, web is dead, long live the internet, you know, and apps are part of that thing. So the things we do are usually trying to find interesting ways to kind of organize and put a social twist on things. So Sportcaster, for example, a leading app, and we'll have an exciting announcement with a big media partner here very shortly that we're going to co-brand with and kind of relaunch the product overall. But Sportcaster is a product that takes all your basic scores, like an ESPN-type app and things like that, but then adds a social twist. So if you're watching the Sporting KC game and you want to see the relevant tweets during that game, Sportcaster is by far the best way to do that. And it doesn't do something just kind of as simple as go out and do a search for Sporting KC, because then you get all a bunch of goofballs, you know, which is kind of nonsense posts. No, what this does is have algorithms to go out and find the most interesting people you would want to follow during that particular game. So if you think about that or a Kansas City Chiefs game, you might know who you want to follow from the Chiefs side, but you might not know all the players and coaches and columnists, you know, from the San Diego Chargers or from the Denver Broncos. And it makes it a lot more interesting, this real-time give and take, you know, that's going back and forth. So we call it live sports with a social voice, you know, Sportcaster.
So through your app, if you're a Chiefs fan and they're playing the Broncos, you can find a Bronco fan or a columnist that covers the Broncos or some president of the Bronco fan club and say, yeah, baby, how do you like that?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, with the Sporting KC, you know, you'll see, see Rob Heineman, you know, one of the owners of it, you know, and basically we filter out, you know, most of the nonsense that just fans. You can turn on fans or you can turn off fans, you know, and a lot of times it's more interesting to kind of turn off and get the local columnists and, you know, and the local radio folks, all those kind of people will be covered.
So that's a area where there's a lot of activity and a lot of conversation and a lot of sarcasm.
Absolutely.
As in, my fantasy team could beat this team. Get it together.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of John going back and forth, and it really is kind of the modern perfect day sports companion.
Now, One Louder, your company, One Louder Apps, was formed from Handmark, sort of a spinoff to handle social applications, business and advertising services, digital advertising services. Why did they make that move, and what does that now entail?
Sure. Well, Handmark is really an amazing story in itself. You know, Augie Grassis and Douglas Edwards founded that company here 12 years ago. And if you think in the mobile space, that's pretty amazing. You know, 12 years ago, back in the days of the Palm Pilot, long before, you know, the Apple iPhone or any of that sort of stuff took place. And, you know, Handmark remains a really interesting company in the space that's just covered all sorts of ground and been kind of an incredible mobile innovator, really across the country, working with every major player in the industry. So a little over a year ago, we made the decision that there's this huge opportunity as it relates to both social and mobile, this kind of marriage of those particular things that just works perfectly on a mobile device. And we'll probably talk more about devices going forward and where the future is going with it. But there is this kind of amazing opportunity. So we decided to create our own brand and cherry pick what we thought were kind of the very best techie mobile developers in the city and frankly, even beyond, and create this area right down, you know, by Power and Light in Kansas City.
You were more of a serial entrepreneur, so this was a natural fit for you. What did you see when One Louder started in the space where you could get in right away? You've obviously made a foothold with apps. What did you see?
Yeah, well, for me, I was just a huge Twitter user myself in the beginning, and I was just personally not happy with the Twitter experience. It was this amazing wealth of information, but when I tried to introduce someone else to it, it was very hard to get them to find, you know, the right content, find the right people to follow, to kind of understand the geek speak, you know, of retweeting and all that sort of stuff that goes with that particular product. So, like all our products, we created the product that we wanted to use, and that was Tweetcaster in the very beginning, you know, and that still to this day is probably the product that most people know us from. And So that's kind of what we've done. We've looked for opportunities to create the things that we just personally want to use. And that led us to Slices, which is a new Twitter product that, you know, that the very essence of that product is bringing content discovery to the forefront. So kind of opening it up to a group of people that Twitter is just kind of a, you know, a big mess, you know, to otherwise.
Is that one of the ingredients to creating what's often called in the industry a killer app or an app that makes noise? Creating an app that you yourself want to use, is that a key ingredient?
I think so. I think I read somewhere fairly recently, you know, if you create a product at the end of the day that you don't want to use, it seems like people should use it, but you don't want to use it personally, yeah, that's probably not a good sign.
I should think not. But what is a good sign is the Social Media Madness Tournament, where you're doing pretty well, emerging as a comer, so to speak. Tell us about what the Social Media Madness Tournament is.
Yeah, it was a thing put on where basically it's a playoff, March Madness, the basketball tournament, of course, you know, where it's kind of pitting companies against each other. It started out with a ton of companies that entered. And we had an employee that just thought, hey, it'd be fun to enter us in this contest. And then, sure enough, we ended up winning the first round. And then we're like, okay, you know, it's pretty cool. Let's get behind this thing. And it's very much, it pits you now in these later stages, just one against one, against another company. It's all based on kind of your social clout, your social influence, combined with this voting process. So you can go out to the website and vote for us. And I think we're down to 16 teams
left
in the country. We're in the Sweet 16.
You're in the Sweet 16.
Absolutely.
Made it out of your region, made it out of your brackets.
Absolutely. That's
right. Didn't get knocked off by Bucknell or anybody like that?
Yeah, yeah. Valparaiso didn't take you out?
Not a chance.
Those are NCAA basketball tournament references for our tech-centric listeners who may not like basketball. I don't know who those people are, but clarification. Inclusion. That's what we're about here on Central Standard. What was the criteria for the Social Media Madness Tournament?
Well, they break it up into different size companies, you know, and frankly, we probably would have preferred to compete, you know, in the open, you know, category, you know, but we're in the sub 100 person, you know, category, you know, and it's really, that's kind of really it. Did you enter? And then how many employees do you have? That's how they divided it up.
And also how much buzz you can generate.
Right. That's whether you win or lose. That's where you win it. So we've got, you know, 3.5 million followers, you know, and on Twitter. And if we, you know, do a tweet or two, we can kind of activate that audience a little bit. And frankly, that's how we do our cross promotion and marketing. We, you know, we built up this ability to launch a new application that most other companies just don't have access to. You know, we can get thousands of people to try it in a day just to give us feedback, you know, to do beta tests and different things like that.
Speaking of which, do you have any strategies and tips for a small business looking at social media and apps to spread a message or develop their business? What do they need to know? And after you, we're going to go to Michael Wilson.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think the key for me when I'm thinking about following somebody is, do they actually tweet or post something of interest? So I think a variety of companies do way too much just self-promotion, talking about you know, what they might think is interesting or what they're hoping that end users will find interesting. But I think the basic idea of going out, thinking about the audience you're trying to reach, and then posting interesting things. The one other thing I'll just add is reposting stuff from other people is interesting, particularly if those other people have a lot of followers. Because sometimes, you know, people will go out and then check the people they already follow and see who else is posting that same sort of stuff. So if you had the art business, you might want to go start following some of the, you know, the art critics that have a lot of followers and start reposting their stuff and kind of just start building up this community. But I think the big thing is sticking to it. I mean, we've been at it for about 2 years to build up where we're at. It's not something you can kind of launch in a week or two and hope goodness will follow.
Michael Wilson, is the world of social media about making the process more organic? Is that what you would tell a business looking to get into social media and apps, make it more organic, less message-y, if that's a word?
Yeah, you know, I really think one of the big things with business is there's two types of businesses. You dip your toe in or you really jump in. And there's a lot of toe dippers. You know, they have the presence and they broadcast all day long. And to me, social media is really about engagement. And so that's one thing that I look at from CEO of our companies. I go engage with other people that are online that have similar interests. And so I will converse with them about a post or whatever it may be and actually reach out to them. And I think that's one of the things that's surprising about social is you can get in touch with some of the most odd, interesting, and well-connected people out there. And from a business standpoint, engaging with your customers and being able to drive that conversation is extremely important. So I think that's the thing that we sometimes forget about.
Our guests are three local technology practitioners from the app creation and design arena. Michael Wilson, the Chief Executive Officer at Wavelength, Jeremy Pavin, a VP of Engineering at iVerify, who we'll talk to soon, and Evan Conway, President of One Louder Apps. We're having a conversation, or a tech talk, so to speak. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, an eye-popping story about Jeremy Pavin's iVerify. That plus what our guests envision for the future of technology business in KC. It promises to be eye-opening when we return. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. The tech startup we're about to learn about as we start this part of the hour in our tech talk gives the phrase iPad a whole different meaning and application. You see, iVerify is an Overland Park-based company that is developing software that will use cell phone camera images of the human eye to confirm a person's identity. We now continue our discussion about apps and tech startups here in KC with our guest Michael Wilson, Chief Executive Officer for Wavelength, Jeremy Pavin, the VP of Engineering at the aforementioned iVerify, and Evan Conway, President of One Louder Apps. But iVerify, Jeremy, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you.
Tell us about iVerify.
So iVerify, the name's pretty self-explanatory, right? We use eyes to verify who people are. So we can do this more accurately than fingerprints can today. Fingerprints is a biometric people are used to hearing about, and we're more accurate than fingerprint. And we can do that with a device people don't leave home without. So the cell phone that is in their pocket or in their purse. And as people live their lives more and more online, so using these apps we've been hearing about today, being able to authenticate that identity is becoming more and more important. So using a mobile wallet, right, making a payment, accessing your bank account, your work network, right, being able to do that confidently, free from fear and fraud is becoming more and more important. And that's an ever-growing pain on these mobile devices. Passwords just aren't usable, right? They're painful. They're not secure and they're not scalable.
So being able to integrate e-commerce and still look a person in the eye, so to speak.
That's right.
All right.
E-commerce is one aspect, but as we've heard today, mobile applications, whether it be social networks or accessing physical buildings, people are doing more and more with these mobile devices.
Now, you said earlier that this is more accurate than fingerprinting. How so?
So, and that's comparing biometrics. So I won't get into the details, but there's technical details on how you measure the accuracy of a biometric. How many people it verifies when it shouldn't verify, or how many people it doesn't verify when it should. So there's a certain number of cases where people might use a fingerprint, but you would misidentify them. So from that perspective, we are more accurate than fingerprint.
Are most cameras good enough to employ this technology, BlackBerries, iPhones, or laptops? Do you have to have a certain configuration in your handset to employ the technology you guys are developing?
You do have to have a couple key specifications. One is the camera has to have the ability to focus. So a lot of the front-facing cameras, so your camera, your phone has two cameras, whether you realize it or not. It's got your back camera and your front camera.
Your back camera?
Your back-facing camera.
I thought you
camera.
Said back camera. That would be pretty cool.
That would be cool.
Pull it from the belt.
Funded by Wayne
my
Enterprises.
Kids would
exactly,
love that.
Exactly. But back camera.
Yeah, your back-facing camera, the one you use to take family photos, right? And then your front-facing camera, the one you use for a video conference. So the camera does have to have the ability to focus, and then it's got to have a certain minimal resolution to get a clear picture. But most of the cameras on the phones today have that ability.
Can you scan from a picture, or do you have to have the naked eye to do it?
So you cannot scan from a camera. So we have a concept that we refer to as liveness. So it's interesting. Eyes are the only exposed organ in your body.
And the windows to the soul.
That's exactly right. So they have a lot of interesting biometric traits that you can look for. So if I have a picture of an eye, that's not the same feeling as an actual organ in front of me. So it's got a rich texture. It's got specific movements that it makes. So we can look for those liveness characteristics during scanning to say we have the real object in front of us when we're capturing that biometric.
And you have specs that are based on, this is not retinal scanning. This is the eye veins in the white of your eyes. What are those called, and how does the technology employ that? How does the technology capture the distinguishing characteristics of the little red vessels?
Sure, sure. So, yeah, vasculature or eye veins that you see in the whites of the eye have a very unique pattern. In fact, if you were to clone yourself, right, at some point in the future, your army clone, it's random. It's not written in the DNA. It's almost chaotic. So it's a unique pattern to each person. Vasculature in the biometric world is getting more and more attention because of its unique pattern and its ease of matching.
So are you cloning people back at your office and seeing if the scan works?
Not yet.
Speaking of which, how does your company, when it's going around giving presentations and talking about the technology, seems very exciting on its face, how does your company address the obvious questions around privacy, bioethics? You know, eye scanning for identity is something you see in spy movies, or worse, something that seems Orwellian a little bit.
Sure.
Everybody literally having their eye on you because of your eyes and the unique characteristics of that. Address that, if you could.
Sure, absolutely. So there's a couple different aspects of that. So one aspect is how easy is it to steal your biometric? And it's actually a lot tougher to get a clear picture of those eye veins than you might think. But even if someone did, we're able to capture an image of your eye and want to fake you. That's where our concept of liveness that we just discussed comes into play. So just because they have a picture, it's still not you. It's still not your real eye, being able to tell that difference. The third aspect is responsibility. Once you have the ability to confirm someone is who they say they are and know that identity, you have to use it responsibly. So giving users the ability to determine who they want to share their identity with and how those people use it.
So for all our martial arts fans or action flick fans or like Steven Seagal movie fans, if you karate chop somebody and take their eye out, it's not going to work with your technology, is it?
No, it's not. So because they're eye veins, by definition, blood is flowing through those eye veins. So if someone were to steal your eye, your veins would dissipate. So that wouldn't work.
Yeah, you can't do a Kill Bill and then walk up to somebody with your technology and get it scanned.
That's right. We haven't tested that yet. But yes, theoretically, that's correct.
So theoretically, it's correct.
It's in the works?
You don't know. Is it in the works?
No, that's not in the works.
Now, getting to the financial aspects of your company and the entrepreneurial aspects of your company, you just closed on a $1.4 million round of financing. Do you know how your company plans to use that seed money? Is it mainly for more R&D? Is it for marketing? Is it... How will that shape out?
A little bit of all of the above. So we actually did not intend to raise that much money initially, but we had so much interest in what we're doing in our technology that we decided to go ahead and allow other interested parties to take on a little bit more money to do a few things. One, more R&D. So
research and development.
Thank you. Research and development around liveness, speeding up the algorithms, different algorithms. As well as speed up some of the other development efforts. So we're focusing on the iOS, the iPhone platform. We've had a lot of interest around the Android platform as well. So we're going to bring that development forward and start working on that.
On Twitter, Austin writes, "How will iVerify prevent using a photo of someone's eye to circumvent the security?" Now, we just explained that even if you took someone's eye physically out, you couldn't scan it. So you're not going to be able to scan with a photo because you have something called liveness.
That's correct.
The biometric aspect of liveness. You got to be able to literally see the whites of their eyes, Austin. But thank you for your question via Twitter. Now, you mentioned iPad and Android platforms. Those are normally associated with consumers and consumer having smartphones. But your business segment that you're going after is more business to business. Parentheses, B2B.
Well, certainly. And that's where we feel our application best fits in business to business, in terms of we are just going to be an authentication service. So other application providers, those might be application providers with enterprise applications. They also might be application providers with consumer applications. So we will work with that business, but it still might be, at the end of the day, a consumer consumed.
So give us
service.
An example of how that rolls out along the food chain. Give us an example of what business you might go as a business-to-business concept and how that rolls down to the end user.
Sure, absolutely. So we'll take the real obvious one, a bank, right? We'll choose one of the bigger, well-known banks, Bank of America, right? So Bank of America is starting to do a lot more mobile banking, right? And it's very important from a security aspect that they secure that phone. They know who is doing that, those mobile banking transactions. So they would use our service to authenticate users to use their consumer-based mobile banking application.
So if I'm logging on to a computer, I want to check my Bank of America account. Bank of America is employing the iVerify technology. Do I hold a camera up to my own eye? Do I move my eye toward my desktop or laptop or iPad or Android and do it and then access my account? How does that work from the end user?
Great question. I'm going to answer that a couple different ways. So currently, with the technology that is available on the phones today, we are using the back-facing camera. So if you were to use our app today, you'd turn your camera around and hold it up to your eye, and we would do a scan. But cameras, like all technology, continue to evolve and improve at a rapid rate. So the ideal scenario that we are shooting for in the not-too-far future is to use the front-facing camera. So I'm on my computer, I'm on my phone, I'm just looking at the screen. Behind the scenes, the camera is taking a picture of my eyes as I look at the screen and authenticating me. So the authentication would be seamless. I would simply do my web navigation, I'd click on my bank account, and it would immediately take me to my account page without me having to do any other actions because it's already authenticated me behind the scenes.
You said behind the scenes very eerily. Behind the scenes, the camera.
I think
is
he did this with his hands,
yeah,
too. Mr. Burns style.
The, you know, mustache, the long mustache. One interesting aspect of this company, iVerify, you use technology from a patent held by UMKC and jointly the University of West Virginia. With all the patent lawsuits going on in the technology space and the changing laws around patents, how does that work? Do you have to kick royalties back up to both the universities? Are they collaborative in the process? How does that patent process that's held by universities work with a private concern?
Sure. So the university has a vested interest in commercializing some of their technologies. So they do take a royalty. They basically license the patent to us, and they get a small royalty off of that. And then we have rights to that worldwide license of that patent and that technology.
All right. So the application is set up on a device. Is it software that's set up on a hardware device?
Yeah, that's what we like about our technology is that it is simply a software play. So you install the application on your mobile phone, and now you've got a biometric that's readily accessible that's more accurate than fingerprint.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host of Central Standard, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are three technologists, three local app creation and design firms, so to speak. Michael Wilson, he's the chief executive officer of Wavelength. Jeremy Pabin, he's the vice president of engineering at iVerify. I just heard him talking about the eye scanning technology. And Evan Conway, the president of One Louder Apps. We're going to open up the floor for questions. We just talked about, Jeremy, the seed financing that iVerify got. I'm going to put this question out on the floor. One of the things we learned about was the seed financing. As technology companies grow here, do you think the local venture capital community will also grow in tandem? The old, if you build it, they will come. Michael Wilson?
I think the Kansas City and especially Midwest market, it's very different than what you typically find out in the Valley. Out in the Valley, they're willing to put money into ideas, not necessarily anything that has monetization or any idea on how to monetize things. And I think in Kansas City, which, you know, you can debate whether it's good or bad, is really more interested in on how you're going to create revenue models rather than how you're going to create users.
Now, when you say Valley, we don't mean San Fernando Valley.
No.
That's known for an entirely other industry.
Or Mill Valley.
Or Mill Valley.
Yeah.
You mean?
San Francisco.
Silicon Valley.
Yes.
Just.
Yes.
It's all about clarification.
Yeah, no, we want to make sure I double clarify on that one. Yeah, out in San Francisco, what people put money into, and sometimes millions of dollars, is about gaining users, and we'll figure out how to monetize
right.
it later.
Right.
And the Midwest mentality is about revenue models. How are you going to generate a revenue model for this as fast as possible. And I think over time, as technology gets better and we're able to deliver these type of markets, the view and philosophy will change of those venture capital firms to where it'll be less about how are you going to be a $1 million company in the first year and more about how are we going to be able to create users, how are we going to create value. And that's really what it boils down to, is once you start putting those that money into what the value is, the money comes through that.
Evan, you're sort of a entrepreneurial carpetbagger in the sense that you are not from a local place. What does the different venture capital cultures of, say, the East Coast and West Coast, how do they compare to KC? He just mentioned people are big on revenue models, stuff that can actually show a plan of making money rather than the concept. Talk about that.
Yeah, I do think when you get beyond, you know, some of the just high-flying examples, it's not so different conceptually. You know, ideas are interesting, but this combination of ideas combined with a good execution plan is what people want to fund wherever they are. In the past, I just don't think there's been much money sitting around Kansas City that's been devoted to technology. And I think that will be the real key going forward, whether we're going to continue to get interesting growth out of here. Clearly, there's good ideas and a bunch of talented people in the area. But most of us in the past had to raise all our money, you know, from outside the Kansas City area. You know, both this company and previous company, really all the investors other than the founders, you know, were from outside the area. So I do think going forward for this kind of innovation growth to continue to happen here, there's no question we need more money to pour into the area.
What creates that groundswell? What creates the environment to where venture capital companies or private equity companies or angel investors, whatever you want to call them, will want to jump in? Is there a single event or a single movement that you've seen in the past that would create that sort of groundswell?
Well, I do think there's a piece of it is this kind of herd mentality. You know,
right.
If there is success, then people want to jump in. You know, and in general, the investors haven't been so innovative, frankly, here locally and willing to kind of take the chances that maybe have been taken in some of the other areas of the country. So I'm hoping a company like ours sitting at this table here and a whole variety of others, you know, that have been here and not just Kansas City, but the Midwest region in general will have some success because money will pour to wherever there is success. If we have success here, the money will come.
Jeremy Pavin, the biotech industry is well known for getting money strictly for research and development and rolling out its concept maybe 2, 5, 7 years without even an actual product, let alone a revenue model. Here with iVerify, you have a slightly biotech model with an information technology application, sort of a hybrid. How does your company play into that discussion? It's not, you know, a sexy user app, but it's very useful and very cool.
It is. And we had a lot of interested parties in terms of investing, especially here locally, which is encouraging. So I think when you can speak to the pain point, whether you're immediately bringing in revenue or not, people get that and understand it.
The pain point.
That's right. That's right. In addition, I think, especially here in Kansas City, as more and more of these entrepreneurial startups are successful, I think that feeds on itself. So as you have entrepreneurs who are successful in that, they start to feed that cash back into the community. So I think we're starting to see some of that with some of the companies that have been successful.
And how do they typically feed it back in the community? Through collaboration, through investments, through joint ventures, what?
All of the above. In fact, I can think of a couple companies that have been successful that those founders have moved on to start local venture capital firms to encourage investment in the local Midwest region.
That's what happens sometimes. You're a serial entrepreneur, and then you want to lay back and...
That's exactly right.
Get the roots of your spoils.
That's right. You've got some free cash. You know the space. You know the risks. You know the rewards.
Get some kit for your caboodle.
That's exactly right.
Stuff like that. Now, where do you see the current gold rush of mobile applications and mobile technology going, Michael Wilson?
Well, it's like anything. It was like how the web was. You start out with a few firms that are innovators that move forward, and then you really get this huge dilution of the market, and you get hundreds of people doing the same thing, and then over time, the ones that really do a good job stay around, the other ones disappear. And the mobile side of things, I really see technology is really driving down the skill set it takes to actually build a mobile application. Same thing with web. Web's, you know, let's say 10 years ahead of it, and now there's point-and-click software to be able to build websites, and they actually look kind of good. But, you know, I can see that the over time execution gets commoditized. And so, you know, really it's that strategic piece that the firms that are most strategic and have good ideas and really know how to execute, not necessarily just executing, but know how to execute, are really going to be around here for a while. And so we're going to see more and more people get into this game, but give it 5 years and we'll see who's still around.
Evan Conway, were you texting while I was talking? Were you on your smartphone while we were trying to have a conversation about smartphones and mobile technology?
I was tweeting, actually. So if you go to Evan Conway on Twitter, you'll see a picture of our host right now that I just sent out.
All right. That makes up for it. Speaking of which, you talked about how the Wired said the web's dead and the internet, long live the internet. Talk about that concept, and what's your prognostication going forward for the mobile application space and the sort of platform agnostic user experience?
Yeah, well, just in general, we do mobile apps, but what we're trying to create is interesting user experiences. And right now, apps are the best way to deliver that. Anything that's repeatable that you're going to do over and over and over again, you can do better on an app than you can on the web. And when you combine that with this amazing set of distribution channels, you know, which is Apple and Google, I mean, that is the place you go find cool stuff, you know, for your mobile phone at this point. Amazon's trying to get into the game and become a distribution channel like that. So when you start to think about those, you know, kinds of things, and think about the kinds of things you might want to use an app for, you know, it's kind of endless, you know, what it could be. In the future, I think you're going to see this blurring of devices. So right now, you think about your desktop, then you think about your tablet or your iPad, and then you think about your phone. But more and more, these experiences are starting to blur. In fact, you know, when we're designing Slices, our new Twitter experience, we thought about that from the beginning, and we synced the Twitter experience across, let's say you're on an Android device, but then you have an iPad, and then you've got a laptop. It knows where you left off as you bump from, you know, different device. And I think more and more, you're just going to see this kind of blurring of experiences. It's been talked about forever, you know, leave your house and continue in the car, continue in the office. But it's becoming very real right now. It's getting even hard to define whether it's a tablet or a phone. Some of these new Android devices, the 7-inch tablet is very much like a phone. And, you know, these big screens on our phone. When I first got my first cell phone in 1996, it was pretty big. You know, and now then they shrunk to tiny, and now they're getting bigger again. It's pretty amazing. It all depends on what you want to do with that device.
We're talking tech with Michael Wilson, Chief Executive Officer for Wavelength. We got Jeremy Pabin, the VP of Engineering at iVerify. I think he scanned my eyes on the low. Evan Conway, President of One Louder Apps, is also in the house. Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And to check out discussions that took place on our recent Appy Hour shows, Appy Hour is an ongoing series. Last time we had RareWire, Moblico, and Lantern. You can go to kcur.org for this show and all other shows. Our show is produced by Andrew Salenzi. Up to date is next with James B. Steele, whose book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.